This is page 97 of The Unfolding. It's the story of Marcus Rixon.
All of that set in, and then my brain just clicked. It's like lightning struck, and I was like, all right, this is it. This is my one shot, my one opportunity, and I'm not stopping.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in The Unfolding.
Hi, this is Meredith Foster. One of the challenges of growing up in poverty is limitation, the limits on education and opportunity. Marcus Rixon grew up in a 12-foot-by-6-foot home with no running water in India. But his greatest challenge wasn't a tiny home. It was the box that kids like Marcus grow up in, a box that defined you and your potential based on where you came from. But Marcus had a dream, a family that loved him, and faith in a box-busting God.
I was born and raised in Calcutta, India. A lot of people recognize Calcutta from the city that Mother Teresa did all her work, missionaries of charity. So that's where I was born and raised. It's a pretty big city. It's about 16 million people.
Wow. But
I grew up right in the heart of Calcutta with my mom, dad, and my sister in a small home. We weren't anywhere rich, but we were living our dream. I grew up in a home that was 12 feet by 6 feet wide, pretty tiny. Mom and dad slept on a floor, and I shared a bed with my sister till I was in high school. We had a stove, a little refrigerator, and a little radio, and that's what I come from. I went to a Christian school called the Assembly of Gods. It was started by some missionaries that came to India. I attended that school all through high school, and it was different growing up in India than now where I live in Nashville, Tennessee. Definitely we were the minorities because the people around us were either Hindus or Muslims or of different religious upbringings. And here we were a Christian family.
When you were growing up, you said something to the effect of, you felt like you were living the dream. Did you have aspirations about, what you wanted your life to look like?
The amazing thing is, what I meant by saying that was I did grow up really poor, and my parents, they took care of me and my sister and provided for our family and did everything they could within their means. But financially, we were poor, but we had a loving home and we had a supportive home that I didn't know any better, So I was like, life was good when I was small, because I was like, I had everything that I need, even though from the outward perspective from the rest of the world, we didn't have running water. We didn't have the power would go in and out. We had holes in our roof, and when it rained, water would drip down. But I didn't know any better. So we were living our best life where we were. So growing up poor in the city of Calcutta, my parents just did not have the means to put me and my sister through school, a good school that was an English-speaking school, and give me a proper education. And they had approached this organization called Mission of Mercy, which had a school in the city that you could apply for to find a sponsor back here in America or around the world that would actually pay to help you go to school and provide a meal. Hmm. So my parents approached the school, and it took about 6 to 8 months. And they were like, they got a call back one day, be like, hey, I know you applied for your son to attend our school, and we actually found a sponsor. So that even gave me the opportunity when I was 3.5 years old, or I think I was almost 4, to go to a school and experience what education and health and everything that came with it. What they did was Mission of Mercy, which now has rebranded themselves to One Child, was able to find a sponsor that paid for my tuition fee, my lunch, my uniform, my books, and took that burden off my parents. One child was my window to going to school right from for 14 years. I had a sponsor back here in the States that helped me walk through that journey. And so was my sister, a sponsor kid. So I wouldn't have gone to school without the sponsorship aspect, because we just couldn't afford that.
So the fact that you did get to go to the school, now it changes the opportunities that you might have. When did you have a sense of, you know, what you thought you wanted to do?
You're absolutely right. Going to school just changed my narrative. Education, especially in a country like India, where the poverty level is either you're super poor or you're super rich. Mm-hmm. There's no middle ground. And so the only way to get out of the super poor is through education. When I was in the eighth grade, attending a Christian school, which was started by missionaries in India, there were a lot of mission trips happening. Like, they would bring people to town, and we had a chapel every single day. And in the eighth grade, there was a team of, I would say, like, young college kids or something like that came and like sang in chapel and shared a message. And I was like, man, we don't have anything like that out here. What I mean, like, I've never seen anyone just be like, hey, I'm going to go play some music or sing a song in English. Like, we did chapel, but I was like, these kids are making, they made a life out of it. They're in college, and I guess they were a worship group. I was like, that's interesting. So I talked to my music teacher, like, hey, can you give me some ideas of what are different aspects of music that I can look into? And he went straight into, obviously, he said, you know, if you want to be a musician, you need to take classes. And I was like, that's not what I want to do. I want to help create music. And then he kind of spoke down the line of a audio engineer. And I was like, huh, someone that runs sound for bands and musicians. And so in the eighth grade, I knew I wanted to get into music. I just didn't know what that was. And it was because of chapel. And then I started serving at chapel with our audiovisual technical team. And it was never a position, but I just started showing up every morning, and I would help them set up. I did that right from the eighth grade to the 12th grade when I graduated, just because I wanted to just be so much involved. So I knew in the eighth grade I wanted to be in music. I just didn't know what that was. Eventually, I think it was the 11th grade or 12th grade, I found out something called an audio engineering school. And it was in a different city in India. It was in the city of Mumbai, which is Bombay. It's like the Hollywood of India. Mm-hmm. And I looked it up, and I was like, this is what I want to do. And then I started looking at, okay, once I graduate out of high school, how can I make this happen? But you won't believe it, Meredith. It is as expensive to live in Mumbai than it is to live here in America. And I was like, what? I was like, my parents can't even, we're already, you know, at a place where we're just living day to day. And I was like, there's no way that's going to be possible. So that was my initial thought of what I wanted to do. Till after I graduated out of high school, and I decided I couldn't do that, but I had this dream. And then I live catty corner to Mother Teresa's organization. So we do see a lot of tourists and a lot of people from Europe and different parts of America come in. So I was always around Westerners. And a Asbury grad, Asbury University, it's in Wilmore, Kentucky. An Asbury grad had come down to go work at Mother Teresa's and volunteer his time. And during that process, he ran into my dad, and my dad was helping serve we started a small little street program. So in all our craziness and all the amount of things we did not have, we still grew up serving the people around us. So we were running a street program, feeding 250 kids a day from the age of 12 that I remember my parents started.
Wow.
So they were able to use their own funds to kind of feed these kids every day. So this alumni from Asbury ran in and saw this program. I was like, oh my goodness, I want to help and be a part of this. And then he decided to sell his home and house in Bunkerville, Illinois, and move to India for full-time mission work. And during that process, my dad came with him to the States to help him relocate and do all of that. And they were driving through Kentucky, and he was like, hey, I need to go show you my school, the school I attended, and this is, you know, and meet some people. And my dad was like, awesome, let's do it. So they drove to the small town of Wilmo with two stoplights, and they landed up at the construction site for a new media communications building. They were breaking ground on a new building that was going to have a music studio, a TV studio, a theater program, and a bunch of other things that were going in. At that meeting point, my dad and this alumni ran into the president of Asbury and the dean of media communications. And they were just telling them all about the program. And my dad was like, oh my goodness, this is exactly what my son wants to do. Mm-hmm. And
how old were you at this point? Were you out of high school when this conversation was happening?
I was 20 years old at this point. I was out of high school. And for the 2 years that I was out of high school, I was either leading mission trips for my dad's mission work. I was leading trips all over Calcutta in the mountains of Darjeeling, which is like one of the mountains close by to unreached people groups, and also working at Dish Network. I was typical Indian kid here. First job out of high school, I worked for Dish Network, and I was the guy that called people and be like, hi, this is Marcus calling from Dish. I have a special offer for you. Oh, at $29.99, I got a two-room DVR, and you get 400 channels free. It was like I had the spiel down, and I did that for a year and a half, and
oh my
goodness. I do not miss it.
That's hard work.
It did help with my persistency. I ate nose for days, and I talked to a lot of people. And my work hours were from 10 o'clock at night till 8 in the morning because of the time change from India to the U.S. And so I was back in India doing all this fun stuff. And my dad was here in the States helping this alumni and started this conversation. And the president and the dean were like, oh, okay, let us get a hold of someone at the admissions department. And he goes in and has a conversation, doesn't ask about pricing or nothing, and calls my mom and says, hey, I'm here at the admissions department, and can you go ahead and send Marcus's transcripts over? Because I've been out of school, so I've had all my paperwork ready to go. And so she faxes it over, and I'm not even in Calcutta. I cannot remember where I was. I was leading a mission trip somewhere. And I get an email, and this is in November. I get an email saying, hey, we've reviewed your stuff, and you've been accepted to Asbury next fall.
Wow.
I was like, what?
Did you know anything about what was going on?
No idea. The only thing I knew about Asbury was this alumni that was with us. So I Google Asbury, and if you look at Asbury in Google Maps 11 years ago, it just looked like a cornfield. You know, it just looks in the middle of nowhere for a boy from Calcutta. I was like, what is going on here? And then I dug in and I found some pictures, and then I found a webcam that was facing this building that was being built. And it was a live feed for the new media building. And so then I started reading into the program that got me super excited. And I was like, wow, this is amazing.
In those 2 years since high school, had the dream for you diminished at all? The passion for that dream diminished?
Absolutely. Those 2 years out of high school were probably my darkest years as a person, even walking in faith, because I just lost it. I just lost the faith. I had friends that were in college at this point in time in India, either going to an engineering college or the medical field or teaching. And here am I, just a high school kid. But I didn't want to do those things because I just didn't have a passion for it. And I was working a job that was hard. And it was a hard time. And I learned a lot in that time. But it was the darkest time. And going to college saved me. It took me out of that spot where, you know, I didn't like going to church anymore because I grew up doing all those things. I just stopped believing in things. So it was hard. But when I saw God opening those doors, as I was talking about, and so I got admitted in November, and now come March of next year, I was like, I didn't even know this thing was really solid or happening. And I didn't even grow up knowing what the system is. I grew up in India. Yeah. I don't understand what GPA is, or what credit hours is, or what's a liberal art education. I have no idea. So in March, they're like, all right, it's time to sign for classes and this and that. And here's what your first bill is going to be. And I was like, whoa. My parents looked at it and were like, we'll figure it out. at that point in time, the president's email address used to be on the university's website. So you could email the president. My mom and dad emailed so many times that that feature is there no more. And it's probably because of me. There is no feature for you to send notes to the Asbury University president. And that's because of me.
What was the content of their emails?
It was, my son is here and he really loves to, would love. And they were like a page long emails. So it wasn't like a short note, but right, kind of just telling, here's a situation. And here we are, a Christian family, and want to better ourselves. And this would be a perfect school for my kid. And this opportunity would be life changing. And just like, you know, what could you do to help us? You know, we're willing to invest everything we have. Wow. And I wouldn't be at Asbury without the president and the staff and the admissions team. They went above and beyond to find things that did not even exist. Because I was an international student, I'm not allowed to have loans in the United States. So basically, I had to come being able to pay 100% of what my bill was. So college in India for a year is $1,500. College here is $30,000 a year. Completely not. But with all the help and months of prayer, they found scholarships and found a job for me on campus. I worked as the assistant carpenter. I never left campus. So I just worked to pay the bill and figure out to get my flight ticket to come to America 7 days before I could classes started. I got my visa 3 days before I left.
Whoa.
And I didn't get to tell people bye. I didn't know when I was coming back. You know, I had $60 in my pocket and a suitcase. And that's how I got here. I got here just tired and just like, it was my first plane ride. I've never been on a plane. So I took four plane rides to get here. It was overwhelming, but it was God. And it was all the people that were praying behind me. And going back to, you know, I was at a dark time getting here and for the first few weeks, but then God just showed me how faithful he is. And one thing I took to heart was all the blessings that are in front of me. Obviously, I worked hard to do all of this, but my parents were equally invested in me. And a lot of the blessings that I was getting were trickle down blessings from them, from my sponsors that poured into me so I could go to a school, and my teachers and my university president that gave me this opportunity, and my sister who, you know, had to sacrifice and go to a college in India, not America, versus I got that opportunity. So it's like all of that set in, and then my brain just clicked. Everything just like, it's like lightning struck. And I was like, all right, this is it. This is my one shot, my one opportunity, and I'm not stopping.
So many had made sacrifices to get Marcus to this place. He knew he had to make the most of this opportunity, and failure was not an option. Part two of his story is coming up, but first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Habib, it seems like there's an astonishing lack of humility in our culture today. And I see it as I'm scrolling social media. I see it in my own heart, too. And it's so discouraging. But I heard you talk about the value of humility. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I struggled with that, too. Over my life, you look at people, and the people that you admire are not the people who have things and are boastful about it. Sometimes you meet somebody who is so kind and humble, and you find out they've got a lot. They either are rich, they have degrees, they got awards, all these things. And I remember how endearing that is to me and how offended I am or like put off by other people who are boastful. Actually, even in the Old Testament, you read over and over how God humbled the Israelites because they became boastful as God's people. He didn't like that. People wanted to sit in the front seats in events with Jesus' time. And he says, you sit in the back so that the host tells you, come on up front. Every time I read things like that, I'm going, if I am arrogant, I'm not really following what God wants me to be. You know, we all have to deal with that. It's normal.
One of the ways that you can expose yourself to that encouragement to choose humility, a lot of great stuff on your website.
HabibHabib.com. Motivational and inspirational minutes, stories, and other things. And I'm so grateful for the many good role models that I've had in my life.
And now part two of Marcus Rickson's story. So now you're ready to kind of hit the ground running. Can you talk about what happened to your faith during the time you were in college?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, coming here with $60 in my pocket and no one to be like, hey, give me advice on what I need to do next,
yeah.
you know, except for my roommate and college professors. And there was a lot of asking, failing, making mistakes and learning. What I did was I embraced anybody in arm's distance. I didn't have a car, so I needed someone to take me to Walmart so I can buy body wash and some kind of groceries, or I needed a friend to lend me $20 so I can go get ramen so I can survive in the summer till my next paycheck. So it was a lot of steps of faith, but during classes, I really enjoyed anything that had to do with my major, and I just excelled at it. One thing I found that I started enjoying again and had missed out on, Asbury has chapel 3 days a week. So I got to attend chapel and hear these speakers and hear music again and people playing music and ministry. And I was like, all right, we're back to doing these things that I love doing and I was passionate about. And then I got to work in the studio, and my professor, his name is Barry Blair. He was one of the founding members of Audio Adrenaline, a big Christian band back in the day.
Yeah.
So I got to learn from him and hear the stories he had. And I started serving down the street at a church called Southland Christian Church. That was a big mega church, but they had the best sound equipment. So I started running sound for the worship band at night. And so it got me back into the faith aspect that every place I went, Jesus was there. Again, being a part of that community and the people around me that were always willing to have a conversation and always kind of support me. Now, going back to school and paying my bills, I had to pay my bills no matter what. And it got harder for my parents to keep doing that consistently. So when end of my sophomore year, I get an email from Asbury, be like, hey, you know, we've kind of delayed your payment plan so that, you know, your family can pick up. But at this point in time, just because of all the laws and the regulations in the country, you have to clear $10,000 in the next 30 days. Otherwise, you're going to get deported. This is my end of my sophomore year. My heart dropped. I was like, God, you couldn't bring me this far. I got 2 more years. I got to figure this out. Call my parents, and they're just like, we're trying to reach out friends and family and try and see how we can come up. And all their savings, everything was poured into me. And I was like, just so brokenhearted. And it was a summer, and my summer job was to be a carpenter on campus. And I was an assistant carpenter, worked with a carpenter. And everybody at the FIS plant, the physical plant that did the work in San Juan, was praying for me. And the carpenter comes up and was like, hey man, I know this is not the perfect situation, but we're empty nesters and our kids are grown up and left. Would you consider leaving campus and come living with us? And maybe that will take your room and board off that bill.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I'm tearing up right now. And that took $6,000 off the $10,000. It was first hurting because I was like, it was almost became a little embarrassing because I'm like, oh gosh, I can't finish school anymore. I'm going to get deported. Who am I going to ask? And this stranger and this person I've been working with decided to let me into their home. And I lined up living with them for 2 years, and that saved me from coming up with an extra $6,000 each year and for my family to come up with that money. Super grateful.
Yeah. It's incredible to hear. I mean, as you listen to this trajectory of your life, sometimes doors opened and you walked through, sometimes you had to push on them. It was never like you could see a mile down the road, but you could take one next step. It's interesting because the whole time you're in college, you never knew what would happen in the next semester even, but it was mm-hmm. just the next, you could take one next step.
It was. I didn't know what 2 months down the line is going to look like. Mm-hmm. So it was very like, I had to be alert. I had to give it my best because this might be my last shot. And so, you know, if it was with people, with my classes, knowing when Jim, who asked me if I would do that, that was such a blessing. But I didn't even know that he was talking about, hey, come live with us for the next 2 years, you know, mm-hmm. so you can get through college. And then while I was there, I still had to figure out the other $4,000 with my family. And that was friends, family chipping in and me just working a bunch of overtime, going and doing jobs that I would normally would not want to do. Mm-hmm. Like, but it was very one step at a time kind of a thing, but putting my best foot forward each time. And in all that craziness during school, I needed an internship and I needed to find it at a place in my junior, senior, finding a place that I felt like this is going to be my best shot because I only had so much to give. I couldn't blow it. And for my major, which was audio production, I needed to find something that was within that field. If it was working at a recording studio or a TV studio, a TV station, a radio station. And a lot of my friends at college were looking at places around Lexington, Kentucky, which is 20 miles from Wilmore. And I was like, I hear you guys and I'm super supportive, but I need to find something in Nashville. That's where I need to be.
Why did you feel that drive toward Nashville?
It's literally called Music City. I was like, it's that black and white for me. It's called Music City. Mm-hmm. And I come from a city, Calcutta is known as the city of joy. And that makes sense to me. So it's like once with a name like that, I was like, that's what I want to do. That's where all the excellent people are. Mm-hmm. That's the people that are the best of the best. And I want to be the best of the best. How do I get in? So I didn't have a car. I hitchhiked with a couple of my friends to Nashville. I ran into this band and you might know them. They call Unspoken. Mm-hmm. They're a Christian band. I met them downtown Nashville at the Comfort Inn's parking lot. I never met them before. I didn't even know what they looked like. They didn't even know what I looked like. We found each other on like Facebook Messenger or something. And they were like, hey, meet us here at 6 a.m. in the morning. So I had to have people hitchhike through the night to get me to Nashville so I can be in a parking lot to meet these guys that I might help intern with. And they show up and Unspoken at that point in time, they didn't have a manager. They didn't have a record deal. They were just playing music around the Nashville area and around the country. And they drove up in a Volkswagen Jetta. And I'm standing in this parking lot at 6 a.m. with a backpack and I'm sure people are like, what is going on? And this Jetta just circles around this hotel. And then it comes and stops. And they're like, hey, are you Marcus? I was like, hey, are you Unspoken? They're like, yeah. They're like, yeah, we have the middle back seat. And I was like, cool. And then I jumped in for 2 weeks. Later on, I find the story. They tell me, yeah, we circle because we didn't know how big a dude you were and if you'll fit the middle back seat.
This is the glamorous life of being a musician and an artist. That was a great introduction to it, wasn't it?
Yep. So I rode middle back seat in a Volkswagen Jetta with two guys from Maine, one from Dominican Republic and the other one from Puerto Rico. And it was the best experience I could have ever had. I worked for $5 in a chicken dinner, as I remember. But I helped run sound. I helped set up the merch. We went through all these no-name places through Kentucky and Tennessee and Indiana. And it was such a blast. Mm-hmm. And then this was the summer, junior year summer. And I go back to Asbury like, hey, so I found these guys and I wanted to do an internship. They're like, well, it needs to be a little more structured. I was like, no. So I was like, okay, I got to find a recording studio now. So I hitchhiked back and I tried emailing and reaching out to a bunch of studios in Nashville. I never heard back from any. So I had one of my friends make a map of these studios. And I went door to door knocking on these studios saying, hey, do you have an internship? Is there anything I could help with? And I landed up knocking on the door of Blackbird Recording Studios. It's probably one of the biggest studios in Nashville, owned by Martina McBride and John McBride. And I got to meet the house engineer and I was like, hey, I'm looking for an internship for the next 3 months and I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And he was like, cool, start from next week.
How many doors do you think you knocked on or emails sent before you got that? Well, yes.
I probably sent about 50 emails, mm-hmm. but the knock on this door was probably door number 3 or 4.
Again, it's this, I mean, you have a drive, which I think is I just love hearing about it because it's inspiring. Because I think for many of us, like one no and we cower in the corner. You didn't hear back from any email, and you, instead of cowering in the corner, you hop in the car or you hitchhike and start knocking on doors. I just think there's something really cool that inspires me.
Thank you for saying that. I just thought I was a crazy kid showing up in people's doorsteps and just saying, hey, what can I do? And yeah, John McBride, loved learning from him and from Martina and from the best of the best, their studios. I got to work with everybody from Dolly Parton to Tim McGraw, to the Doobie Brothers, to Old Crow Medicine Show, to Taylor Swift's producers. I didn't even know the level of what I was going to enter into. And
was that like dream come true for you?
It was. It was like I was spoiled. I was touching consoles that cost $500,000. As a kid from Calcutta, how did I even get here? And then this was all before my senior year at Asbury. Just crazy. I come back and I start doing classes at Asbury. And then one of my professors is like, hey, there's an opportunity to go and work the Olympics in Sochi, Russia. So I applied and I got it. I got to go to Sochi and help run sound for figure skating and speed skating. And had the best experience of my life. All before I graduated college.
Wow.
Then I come back to college. I'm finishing classes. I've been dating this girl of my dreams. And I was like, all right, it's time for us to like decide on next steps. And we were like, okay, we're going to move to Nashville once we get married. And so we decided first we wanted to just finish college. And that's what we did. And we didn't get married till about 6-7 months after we graduated. But we decided that Nashville was going to be a thing. I didn't have the money out of college to move to Nashville. So I just got an apartment in Wilmore. I got a place, but I would commute from Nashville every Thursday night. I would drive up, jump on a tour bus. Sorry, Wednesday night. Jump on a tour bus Wednesday night. Tour Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Get off the tour bus and drive back to Wilmore. And
this was your job? This was like your first real job out of college, or
first real job out of college? I was running lights for Unspoken. They call me up like, hey man, I know you went to school for music, but we already have a sound guy and we already have a record label and a manager, and they hooked us up with the people we need, but we bought a bunch of lights for our Christmas tour. Can you come help run it? And I was like, absolutely. Yes. So I came to Nashville and got a crash course from the team that did it for 10th Avenue North. They're another band. They taught me in 3 hours, and then I ran lights for a tour for 40 dates. And then the next tour, I became the sound guy. The next tour, I became the tour manager. And then after that, I had met so many artists and so many people in the music industry that Mark Schultz, which is another platinum-selling Christian artist, was like, hey, man, I love when we're on the road, and I love all the ideas and thoughts you bring. And I feel like you're more valuable than just being a sound or a lighting or a tour manager. And I love for you to look at managing my career.
Wow. Like, how old were you?
26, 27.
Oh my goodness. To think about the eighth grade kid in Chapel, you know, who's exposed to this music and goes and talks to the music teacher. And I think I'd like to do something like that. 14 years later, and you're managing a multi-platinum artist. Could you ever have imagined, but you strike me as the kind of guy who, you could imagine that. Could you imagine it?
So I would say I could. The answer is technically no, I couldn't imagine it because I didn't know what there was. But while growing up, you know, because of where I came from, there's only a certain, like, there's a box that's built around us as humans, you know, it kind of defines you where you come from a little bit. I was like, I got out of that box and I'm out of that box. And I can imagine I'm living my dream at this point in time. I'm living past my dream. And so for me to manage a platinum selling artist, I can imagine it now because I've done it. But earlier I was like, what am I doing? How did I get here? And, you know, I didn't manage just one platinum selling artist. I helped manage Jackie Velasquez, Sandy Patty, Phillips Craig and Dean, and right now I have Sayla. The list just goes on.
Wow.
And but I am outside my box, which is hard to explain, but I dream big. I dream big because I'm like, huh, I'll just, if it's a no, it's a no, but I'll just keep working at it. I wake up every day and I'm so blessed and I'm so grateful for my opportunities that I know this sounds cliche, but I don't go to work every day. I'm living my dream every day. Here's a cool little story. As I said, Mark asked me to be his manager, and I've done every position possible that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a lighting guy, a sound guy, a merch guy, a bus driver, a case pusher, a coffee guy. I have done it. And so I appreciate all of those people and give them the respect that they very well deserve. So I still keep up with all those people. But when I became a manager, I make sure my artists know that I appreciate all they do. And I appreciate the crew that goes out because I've been there and done that. But in all of this, while I manage Jackie Velasquez, we have nonprofit organizations that approach Christian artists to represent them at concerts or on the social media and things like that. So we're sitting in a meeting in Jackie's house, and we're approached by the organization One Child. And it's me, Jackie's booking agent, and the president of One Child and the VP of One Child. They flew in from Colorado Springs, and Jackie and her husband. And we're sitting at this dining table having this conversation about Jackie Velasquez representing them. And during the conversation, Jackie and Nick, that's her husband, says, oh, we know all about child sponsorship. You know, we sponsor our manager. Monthly, we send him a paycheck. So, in a joking way. Uh-huh. And I was like, so then the president of One Child was like, wait a second, are you a sponsored child? I was like, not to Nick and Jackie, but I did grow up in Calcutta. And I grew up having a sponsor that helped me go to school and things like that. And the president from One Child, his name is Mark Plummer, sitting across the table, his eyes kept getting bigger. Mm-hmm. He's like, do you know what that organization is called? I was like, man, I don't really know what it is now, but it used to be called Mission of Mercy. And his jaw just dropped and he was like, we changed our name 10 years ago from Mission of Mercy to One Child. And everybody in the room was like, what just happened? Pin drop silence. And then that's when I realized, because I didn't know them as One Child. I knew them as Mission of Mercy. And so Mark and his buddy fly back to Colorado. And next day I get a text from them at 6 a.m. in the morning. So I don't even know what time it was in Colorado. It's probably super early, but it was a little picture of me on a packet as a kid. And so at this point in time, Jackie's like, I guess we're in. Then Mark gets on a call with me and I'm actually with Mark Schultz at this point in time. We're driving to a show and Mark Plummer gets on a call with me and starts telling me all about the ministry and then telling me, yeah, you were sponsored for 14 years by this couple, Dave and Regina. I was like, man, I would love to meet them someday. A year later, they were like, hey, we'd love to get your story on video. And we're going to be in Nashville. And would you be open to sharing that? And I said, absolutely. So I'm sitting in a studio in Nashville, just sharing my story about how I got here and college and music. And then at the end of it, they were like, hey, would you want to meet your sponsors, Dave and Regina? They're sitting downstairs watching you right now. And so you're walking Dave and Regina. I've never had an image or a face or a picture or a name. They walk into the room and I'm just an emotional wreck.
Do you remember what you felt in that moment?
Gratefulness. I felt gratefulness. I felt here are my champions, my angels that I've never seen, but have been there right throughout my time. I just broke down. And at this point in time, my wife, Abby, was in the room and she was 2 weeks away from giving birth to our little boy, Elliot. So she was in a mess. And it was a really powerful time. And then I got to meet them and hug them and learn about them. And they're from Memphis, Tennessee. They have two daughters, both live here in Nashville.
Wow.
And one of the daughters lived right by the school where my wife taught at. And the other one lives right behind my office down the street.
Wow.
So they've been driving past my office for the past 4 years. And I couldn't even write a script like this. So from that very point, it just changed the angle of the child sponsorship aspect for me. Because now I went from a child sponsor to now I can be an ambassador. I can be a voice for the next Marcus. I can be a voice for the next Nikita. That's my sister. And so I just took it on myself to just share my story with people to encourage them, because here you go, Dave and Regina, they poured into me for 14 years and I got to meet them. And now with my story and with my relationships with artists who have taken on one child and have gone out and spoken on their behalf, I probably have close to 1,000 kids that have been sponsored. And it's the best thing I've ever done. Just one more kid, just having the hope of dreaming like I did.
Marcus talked about how when Dave and Regina and his parents and the staff at Asbury and so many others, when they invested in him, they probably thought they were making a difference for one child. But the reality is it has changed Marcus's family. It's changed the life of his son. And now 1,000 kids who've been sponsored through one child, it's spilling over into the next generation. That's really powerful. You can see the video of Marcus's story and when he met Dave and Regina for the first time. It's at onechild.org/Marcus. You can find Marcus on Facebook and Instagram, or check out his company at ricksonentertainment.com. By the way, Marcus is back at the Olympics this week. He's in Tokyo helping with broadcast coverage of the Olympic Games. Big thank you to Marcus for sharing his story with us. You know, every week we say God is writing a great big story and he's inviting you to be a part of it. So we have a question for you. Has God used the Unfolding podcast in your life? Has this podcast been a part of God's unfolding story for you? If so, we would love to hear about it. Even if your mind, it's just like, this is a small story, that's okay. We're collecting them all, big or small, and we're hoping to share some of those in a future episode. Head to the Unfolding Podcast Facebook page to share your story with us. Please do that. I would love to hear it. Huge thanks to our producer, Jason Rakow, and our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Find out how to unleash the full power of your leadership potential at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page in The Unfolding.